Are you blessed or are you cursed with a strong imagination and a spiritual thirst? Do you wanna confide about the darkness inside? Come and talk about it on Self-Worst.
Hello, welcome to Self-Worst. It's happening. We're doing it. I'm Brad Pearson. What's going on? I'm tired is what's going on. That's where I'm at. I'm a sleepy boy this morning, but I gotta get shit done. My dog is staring at me. She wants me to come back to bed. It's a kind of cold, blustery, windy day. The world just wants me to go to bed. My body wants me to. My dog wants me to. The world is giving me that signal, but nonetheless, I must keep going around doing stuff. That's what it's like to be a person, be a grown-up. You gotta just keep moving along, even though your eyes just feel kind of heavy and but won't always be like this. We gotta go to work. That's what we all gotta do. And we're gonna talk about that a lot with my guest, Alexander Edward. He's from the Minion Death Cult podcast, along with a previous guest of the show, Tony Boswell. He's the other half. And we had a good talk. We mostly talk about, mostly about work stuff, money stuff, world politics stuff on this episode. We don't super go into mental health stuff as it is in this episode. But as I've said before, it all ties together, baby. It's all connected. Your job and your finances, your career path, your economic future, or lack thereof, your financial precarity, the horrifying, fucked up, cruel world around you has an effect on your mental health, as it turns out. If you happen to be an empathetic person and give a shit, you're not able to just put on blinders and live like the people in what was that movie? Zone of Interest. You see that shit? I've been thinking about that movie for like 2 weeks now. Saw it two weeks ago. And it's brutal, man. Go see it. Go see it in the theaters. The sound design is very important. And it's very prescient to what's happening right now. There's hell on earth happening. And just right over there, just right next to it, people are just vibing, hanging by the pool, posting their little TikToks, chilling out. It's an insane world we live in, is what I'm saying. What are you gonna do? I'm the first to observe this. You ever think about how the world's crazy? Yeah, pretty wild stuff. Went to Philly this weekend. That was fun. Almost got to hang out with a former guest of the show, last week's guest. Was it last week? It was last week. Liam Anderson. We didn't quite get it together. You know, we're both busy. We both got a lot of stuff going on and shit. You know, a lot of people to see, places to go. And we couldn't quite hang out, but we're gonna try. Again, Philly's right there. Philly's a hell of a town. You have a harder time. I've had a harder time getting to Queens from Brooklyn. Have a harder time getting to Astoria than I do Philadelphia, PA. Anyway, it's a fun town. Had a good weekend. Saw a friend of the show, former guest Pat King. Stayed out there with him. He's fucking killing it. They bought a house, which you can do in Philadelphia. That's allowed. That's legal for people who aren't bajillionaires. You can actually buy a house there. So it was cool. It's a great town. Had a nice little spring interlude. It's cold again, but it'll get warm again. You know how this shit goes with spring. You get all horny and excited because there's a nice warm weekend and it's sunny and the birds are chirping. And then it's like, guess again, bitch. It's cold now. Oh well. Don't take it personal. That's just nature. we're going to get to the interview. Like I said, I'm tired and I have to go do stuff today. I got to mentally prepare for that. So let's get on with the show. Follow me if you will at Radical Pearson, Instagram, Twitter, Threads, Blue Sky, whatever. And follow the show at Self-Worst. Rate and review us on iTunes, patreon.com/self-worst. I am putting out bonus content for real this time. I'm doing little tutorial videos and posting just little videos of me going around doing shit and hanging out. And at some point, I think I'm going to do a little live stream with some of my listeners. Whoever wants to pop in off the Patreon and hang out and talk and look at stuff on the internet. I don't know. Anyway, look forward to that. And that's all. Hope you're maintaining. Hope you're just getting out there and doing your stuff, even if you're tired. But also listen to your body and rest, you know, and restore. Don't force yourself too hard to do stuff when you feel like you just can't. Maybe I've been trying to get up and work out in the morning, and it's just not happening. I have to like wait until later in the day, which is abnormal for me. I usually do it in the morning, but for whatever reason, I just can't fucking get it together in the morning. I can do it later. So there's always that. I don't know. Also, if you haven't figured this out by now, don't listen to me for mental health advice. I am not well. I'm kind of a fuck up in a lot of ways, and you should really just not listen to me. But I do make a hell of a podcast when I talk to my guests who are more interesting people than me, right? So without further ado, let's talk to Alexander Edwards.
No, I'm on family leave because my partner just had knee surgery, and so the state of Washington actually pays me to stay home and take care of her for the months that she's recovering.
Oh, nice. Yeah, I heard about that via your show, or maybe on RFTB. I'm not sure which, but yeah, I'd heard that she was getting an operation. How is she? Is she doing all right?
Yeah, she's good. She's like just starting to be allowed to put weight back on it, but like not walking weight, just like touching the ground weight. It's she had a crazy knee surgery that's like more intensive than a knee replacement. Like she had a patella stabilization, which is where they stabilize your kneecap. And she had to get like part of her bone chipped away, the part that the patella sits on. And then she had to get like her tendons reattached because they were all stretched out. And then she had an additional tendon added. So she's got an extra corpse tendon, cadaver tendon on her knee now as well.
Okay. Well, that's kind of cool though.
Yeah.
Does her knee bend both ways?
She was already pretty flexible, but no, she needs to build her flexibility back up. Yeah.
Because I think, like, if you're going to have to go through some sort of really invasive and crazy procedure like that, they might as well, like, make some modifications. Give you bird legs or something so you can run really fast.
Or, like, I don't know, rookie of the year status. She finds out she can kick a field goal or something
Yeah, she can kick really hard. She can, like, all of a sudden she has, like, Jean-Claude Van Damme powers. That'd be great. So let's, you mentioned you wanted to talk a little bit about music and stuff. So you make music and you're a big music appreciator. So let's begin there. Who are your guys?
I grew up listening to like classic rock and Motown and stuff like that. So I know a lot of stuff from that era gets, disregarded as dad rock or
not
like
by
corny.
Me. No, it's good shit.
Yeah, I'm
the
like
fucking Doobie Brothers. Hell yeah,
sure. Yeah, I'm one of like the hardcore punk guys who still likes rock and roll. You know, So I love Stevie Wonder. I love Paul McCartney solo stuff is like really influential on me as a piano player. Because yeah, like kind of like I alluded to, playing in like punk and, you know, hardcore and like post-hardcore bands, not a lot of piano, not a lot of opportunity for keyboard typically in those genres, but that's what I play. And so kind of having to like carve a way through noise rock or shoegaze with a piano and a keyboard, you know, you're like kind of looking to what you can draw from. And there's like, there are a few post-hardcore, post-punk bands that do have keyboard in them that are very good, but you know, sometimes they're coming from like a classically trained background. So they're playing more traditional piano stuff over a punk song.
Yeah.
Whereas like what I'm kind of playing is more like rhythm, like rock and roll rhythm piano, with some like post-punk
right
energy.
I mean, unless you're like in the Stooges or something and you're just doing the like ding, 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 ding on the piano. And that's like a rhythmic, but not a lot of like punk bands do the piano thing, which I think they should. I mean, I guess it maybe doesn't fit the aesthetic. You can't lug a piano around in like a crusty van. I'm not sure what the deal is with punks and pianos. They seem very adverse.
It usually you get the piano when it's more like the dance punk side of like the post punk or like death rock, you know, that stuff will have organ or piano. But again, like kind of not what I'm looking for, with what I'm playing. You know, I'm a big fan of like the post-hardcore stuff like Fugazi and Unwound and Chavez and like Dinosaur Jr. and Mogwai, just like the really, I don't know, melodies bigger than God, but also like a pretty punchy rhythm section and some volume behind it. So that's kind of like what I've been working on now. I got like 5 or 6 songs written, and I'm talking. I just emailed a producer to see if he wants to record a demo for me. So we'll see. It's a weird project. So that's why I'm like talking in circles about it just because, I need to like bounce ideas off of somebody else. Cause right now it's just a solo project. So I need somebody and the guy I'm talking to, recorded Blonde Redhead, recorded Unwound and some other kind of grungy 90s punk bands. So I'd be really interested if I could bounce ideas, having him to bounce ideas off of, you know?
Yeah, that's no slouch. I mean, but there are like post-punk bands that do a lot of synth. I mean, they're, you know, The Cure and Joy Division and Talking Heads, like there's synth in a lot of that stuff. And, you know, so that's kind of a keyboard based thing going on. Right. Is that like,
I like that, but
that's a little too like British goth kind of aesthetic.
I think it's like, it's about the beats. Mm-hmm. I don't particularly like the dance beat. I like that tempo maybe, but I like, you ever listen to Stereolab?
A little bit, like way back in the day, in like my college rock days.
Yeah. I love that band.
Yeah.
I loved like the like bossa nova kind of grooves. Like I like the jazz and like Latin, I guess, realizing now like Latin jazz sounding grooves a lot, which is dancey, don't get me wrong, but it's not the off time hi-hat kind of disco sort of danciness that you or like pop danciness that you get from, you know, I like The Cure and I like Joy Division. I like Talking Heads a lot. You know, Talking Heads is probably closer to like, you know, some of their older like wiry guitar sounding stuff. Yeah. I really like that stuff, and that is definitely an influence.
I mean, they veered off into like funk and R&B and all kinds of stuff. So, I mean, you know, by the time they really like peaked as a band, they had really picked up a lot of different styles and sort of conglomerated a lot of that stuff.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, they have a bunch of different sounds, which I really, you know, respect that in advance. There's like something under there. It was, they weren't just like meeting a scene or meeting a moment. There was like some creative, you know, ember underneath all of it that kept pushing and kept changing. And I like that.
Well, and there's a ton of piano and keyboard stuff in classic rock too. I mean, in the Doobie Brothers, I mean, Michael McDonald's a fucking fantastic piano player, and yeah, you know, anything with a Fender Rhodes in it, I'm down to listen to. It's just my favorite instrument. It just sounds so warm and nice and soothing, and it's just I could listen to just, I've been searching for it actually. Just give me a whole album of just a guy on a Fender Rhodes, maybe like a three-piece drum kit, and maybe like a vibraphone, and just real like heroin jazz, real soothing, mellow, you know, slow stuff. That would be great.
Yeah, totally. I was when you started saying just like a three-piece combo with a Fender Rhodes, there probably is like some jazz pianist or keyboardist.
There's
probably
there's a couple of guys like Vince Guaraldi, the Peanuts guy, actually has like a lot of stuff like that. And there's this guy, what is it, Bird, David Bird, Donald Bird, something, Donald Bird, is it? There's the Michael Nora Quartet. There's a lot of stuff like that, but I don't know. It's just, you can find it, but I don't know. Like it's usually like they'll do that for a while, and then they'll veer into like some other, like they'll bring in horns and stuff. And I'm like, no, get that out of here. Get that out of here. But I don't know. All I've been listening to this entire winter, is doom metal. And, I think that's, you know, I mean, I don't know how, like, I imagine it gets pretty, like rainy and gloomy up in Washington State during the winter months too. But like, it's just been raining like all week here. And it's just like, well, no, this just fits the aesthetic. It's just gray. It's just rainy. And you're just surrounded. Like you just feel like death. And, this is what I want right now.
Absolutely. Who are you listening to?
Man. So I've been listening to this band, Gallhammer, for a couple of days. They're like Japanese girls doing, like screaming death metal, and they're really intense. There's this band called Grief that I really like. They have this record called Dismal, that I fucking love. There's this band Moss, that put out a couple of like one of them's like real, like, screamy. One of them is less so. It's like more singy. I love Sleep. I've been more like classic metal stuff, like Cathedral and Sabbath and stuff like that. I've always been into, but I've been trying to find like the more like really slow, esoteric, like very metal for metal guys music, you know, Electric Wizard and stuff like that.
Electric Wizard's sick. I don't know if I would call Electric Wizard metal for metal guys. Electric Wizard is like, they're like the, I don't know, Rob Zombie of metal. Like, I feel like you could put, if anybody like vaguely likes metal,
A lot more approachable. Yeah. They're a little bit more like, that's the, so like,
they're just sick. They got
I work in a wood shop. And sometimes I get to control the music, and, there's like maybe like six other dudes like wandering around the shop doing other stuff. You know, like there's a couple of different, it's like a co-working space, but for like fabricators. Right. And, so there's a couple people who I work with directly. And then there's a couple people who like, we share the space, we share the table saw and all that shit with, but they don't work with us. Right. So when they're in the shop, I'll play something that's a little bit more, you know, just likable and accessible and doesn't sound like as insane. And then when like it's just me and my buddy, my coworker, who's like also like a big metalhead. Then we get to put on like pungent stench and like really like really fucking insane, gnarly, fucked up metal that's just screaming and just sounds terrible and just is scares people. And it isn't the kind of thing that like, you know, everybody can listen to. Like, not everybody gets it, and that's fine.
Yeah, a new album that just came out that's kind of doom metal. It's kind of all over the place. I don't know. Like, I love metal. I like a lot of these genres, but my favorite kind of music, I think, in any genre is a band that's like blending a bunch of different ideas and genres into something, you know, fun and unique and interesting. Slift, you know that band?
Slift. No.
Yeah, they're a French like psych rock kind of. I think it's just a trio. I think it's just bass, guitar, and drumming. And it kind of sounds like desert rock, but definitely more psychedelic, definitely more doom metal inspired. Mm-hmm. And it also has this kind of like garage punk sort of thing going on. You know, like Monotonics back in the day, or like Ecstatic Vision, and even some like sort of hypnotic, like repetitive grooving stuff that you would hear in like krautrock, you know, like Can or whatever. But I highly recommend their new album. It's sick for anybody who likes like heavy psychedelic and like groovy music.
What are they called?
Slift, Slift.
I'm writing that down and I'm gonna check that out later. They're French. Gojira is French, aren't they?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I like them. Metal's for everybody, and you know, like it's a storied and really versatile genre. And sure, there's a bit of a Nazi problem, and there's some of that stuff going on, and you have to be a little bit careful with, like, particularly in like Norwegian black metal, like who you're listening to and who you're endorsing. But you know, like I do a quick Google usually if I discover a new band and you know they have the like that like fucked up scratchy lettering as their logo, and I'm like, cool, these guys sound cool. I hope they aren't like white supremacists and
right. Cross reference their name with National Socialism and see what comes up. Yeah. I don't listen to like a lot of black metal or a lot of death metal. I have like my favorites in those genres, but not enough to like have to watch what I'm listening to, essentially. Because I'm not doing that much exploration in those genres. I think like it took me a long time to get specifically into like black metal and some types of death metal and grind, because I just couldn't hear what the fuck was going on. Like, my hearing is kind of fucked up from years of playing music, and so like, and some of those recordings are really bad. Like, I felt, I don't know, the same way it was like when I first listened to like Infest, or like when I first listened to like my you know, Baby's first power violence band. I was like, I can't even hear the riff. Like, all I can hear is the drums, but they're not recorded well, and I don't even know like what beat I'm supposed to be discerning from. So I had to put a lot of that stuff on the cooler and then revisit it later in life. But yeah, I mean, I love like your big death metal bands. I love, you know, Death. I love Sepultura is like,
yeah, that's a fun one,
favorite metal bands. So yeah, a lot of that stuff is great. There's this band that I've been listening to called Knoll, K-N-O-L-L. You like them? They're like grind, blackened grind or something like that.
Blackened grind.
Yeah.
I love all the specific subgenres. Like it gets very, you know, there's like a whole taxonomy of all these different little, like, very specific. There's the fast ones, there's the slow ones, there's like the sludgy riff ones, there's the it just goes,
well, it's all like you're playing fast, but you're playing like this beat. Yeah. So that type of fast beat is a black metal beat, or that type of blast beat is a death beat, you know. Mm-hmm. But when you switch them up real fast, that's grindcore, you right. know. My favorite genre of metal is like the three-piece grindcore band, like Yautja. That band so fucking sick. Pig Destroyer's great. There's a British band called Helpless that's also really good, three-piece. Something about three pieces, something about like doing the most with just like those kind of minimal elements, and everybody kind of working together. Everybody kind of gets to shine. Mm-hmm. I feel like in those, Helmsley, speaking of Seattle, Pacific Northwest, one of my favorite, all time favorite bands. And yeah, they're like a psychedelic doom post-metal three-piece that I love.
So like, when did you start playing music?
I got piano lessons from my Nana when I was 10.
Aww.
And, you know, thank you, Nana, but I hated it.
Yeah, sure. You're supposed to hate it. You're supposed to not like it for a while and just take your medicine. And it teaches you discipline when your brain is still a little sponge. And they have to kind of force you into it. Like, I mean, my parents, they tried. They made me play violin, trumpet, stuff like that. But I was a bitch and I quit. And you know, then tried to play guitar later and kind of sucked at it because I didn't really have the chops. But you stuck with it.
Well, no, I gave it up as soon as I could. Like I gave it up as soon as they let me. Being taught piano as a child is brutal. Like your treat, you know, you have to do these scales and this workbook and yada, yada, yada. And then like, maybe if there's time at the end of the lesson or at the end of the week, you'll get a treat, which is learning to play the Frasier theme song on piano. You know, tossed salad and scrambled eggs. Like that's your treat for learning to play Camel Caravan in your level 5 workbook or whatever. Just awful shit. So I gave it up real quick. I wanted to play guitar like you did. Gave that up as well. You know, I played it enough to like write some Green Day ripoff power chord pop punk songs. Mm-hmm. Gave it up. And then in my first year of college, I had to take like a music requirement. And so I just took piano, you know, because I remembered a lot of, you know, at least just like the notes and the chords. And, you know, I'm musically inclined to some degree. And so I was just like, I'll just take this. And that was really fun. You know, more piano workbooks had been created in the 14 years between
yeah.
4 years old and 18 years old. And plus I was like listening to indie rock bands that had piano in them and had alternative instrumentation, you know, bands like Arcade Fire or Broken Social Scene. And so I was like, I can make this cool. I can make this like work with the type of music that I want to do. And so that was kind of like my beginning of writing songs on piano. And pretty shortly after that, I started playing in it sounds corny to try and like give yourself hyper specific genre or whatever, but yeah, we were like the shoegaze noise rock kind of band. Like we loved Unwound and My Bloody Valentine and Dino Jr. and stuff like that. But we were also kind of like IE Southern California shitheads. So there was like some, you know, noisier, nastier stuff in there as well. But I was playing keyboard and piano with a really fucking loud rock band. And that was really cool. You know, I'm playing my Casio Privia next to like Orange Stacks, mm-hmm. you know? So I did it. Like I accomplished it. I wrote songs for that band, wrote two or three songs and then like wrote, you know, piano to the songs that I didn't write. And it all kind of worked out. Like I still like those songs. But we didn't ever like blow up or anything. And I left the band because it wasn't like, I was kind of pushing them all in a more, again, like rock direction than I could tell that they wanted to be. And as soon as I left the band, they got really good. They realized their full potential and right. yeah, sounded a lot more like a noise rock kind of Jesus Lizard thing, which was really cool.
It happens. I mean, so, like when Brian Eno left Roxy Music, they got better. And it was just better for both of them to be apart, honestly. They're both good. They just didn't blend. And that's okay.
Yeah, no, those are like my best friends in the world. So it was just the best thing. And played in a couple groups after that. Was in a duo with a female singer-songwriter who played guitar, but she really didn't like playing guitar. She only wanted to sing. And I was like, I'm the only member of this band. You have to do something. So I would like make her play guitar along with like beats that I programmed, and would play live piano to it and stuff. And we had some pretty good responses. It was funny. We were playing like local shows and stuff, and dudes would come up to me and they would be like, wow, it's like so cool to hear real music again. And I was like, I don't want you on my side. we're not on the same team, bro. Like,
what
don't
does that
just
even
because,
mean
just because there's a piano in it and nobody's rapping doesn't mean it's suddenly real music, you know?
Right.
But then we also got told that we sounded like Blonde Redhead, and I was like, okay, cool. I love that band. So cool.
Yeah, so it sounds like music is sort of your main artistic output. I mean, you're mostly known now as a podcaster, and you had I think Tony was telling me you had a podcast prior to Minion Death Cults that was particularly about music.
Yeah, so that's how I started podcast back in like 2014 or something. I was like demoing music and recording my own stuff, and I started listening to podcasts. I was working in a warehouse at UPS, like I would for 9 years, and I discovered podcasts. You know, I was listening to like audiobooks and shit, and then somebody told me about podcasts. I started listening to podcasts. I was like, oh, this is great. And it's just, at least at that, I mean, it can be very DIY, very punk thing to do to start a podcast, which is funny because it's so associated with losers and like reactionaries, you know, but if you don't have $1 million behind you, you can still do a podcast. Getting people to listen to it is the hard part.
Fucking A.
You can do it with a fucking $15 USB mic, you know, and like a $5 a month subscription to SoundCloud or whatever. And I had friends who were working at merch companies who did like hardcore merch, but also like all the new wave of like mallcore that was even worse than the first wave of mallcore. So they would like bring home samplers like from like Sumerian Records or whatever, like, you know, and there's like a couple good records on or good albums from Sumerian Records, but overall really not my thing. And so we would just listen to this what we consider to be really bad music, where it's like, you know, boy band pop punk with then death growl beat downs and shit like that. And it was just like, you know, not and it hilarious to me, but anyway, we would like listen to this music, and we would remind ourselves of really corny music from when we were in high school, or, you know, and so like Broken Side, I don't know if you remember that band. Or like Aiden. Have you ever seen a music video for Aiden?
Aiden. No, I don't think so.
So Aiden is like a post AFI goth pop punk band that is trying to be even more Davey Havoc than Davey Havoc was. And so again, I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. Everybody's got a different taste in music. Stuff that was really annoying to me. And like their music videos are really have to be seen to be believed. Like,
I'm Googling these guys right now. Oh yeah. No, they look exactly like I thought. Yeah. They all have the hairdo. They all have the like black flippy hairdo.
Yeah. It's like, it was like the 2000s version of when Metallica did Until It Sleeps music video, where they were like deliberately trying to be gay.
They were like latter day Metallica thing that I really remember was Saint Anger, and like when they were trying to do like a nu metal thing, and everybody was just like, "How this is not." It was very embarrassing for everybody.
Saint Anger's new metal, but there's also a lot of like grunge on there, and butt rock, and post post grunge on there, and that's what Until It Sleeps was like. That's one of their like fake Nirvana songs, and they're like deliberately trying to look artistic, so they're like wearing eyeliner and they have feather boas. And one of them, and like, yeah, behind the scenes is like, yeah, I guess we were trying to do all this gay shit because it was like what was popular, whatever. It's like Aiden saw that and was like, you know, did it times 10 basically for their stuff. Just like random theatrical imagery, you know? Yeah. But, so the show was called That Awful Sound. And, it eventually became a show where we would talk about like our nostalgic problematic faves. And I don't mean that like problematic in the sense of it was, you know, misogynist or anything, because all music is misogynist. But just like stuff that was embarrassing that we used to like. So like pop punk stuff or whatever. And so every week I would have a guest on and we would revisit a music video that they loved, you know. And we weren't too hard on ourselves, you know. We were fairly, you know, I was like mid 20s at this point, so I had come around and stopped hating everything so much and was able to kind of like, you know, lovingly reappraise a lot of this stuff from our childhood. And, you know, we'd make fun of ourselves, and then we would go through the YouTube comments on that episode, on that music video, as like the last segment for each episode. And that was the genesis of Minion Death Cult. That's like where Minion Death Cult came from.
Right. Because for the uninitiated listener, if you don't know what Minion Death Cult is you dive into the really stinky comment sections on like Facebook posts. It seems like it's mostly Facebook stuff, because that's where like the real boomer brain kind of stuff lives. But it can kind of be anywhere. It's local news articles. And like, I don't know if you, the listener, have ever clicked on the comment section under any just local news article, but people get wild on there, and there's some of the craziest shit you've ever read. And so that's what Alex and Tony do every week.
Yeah. We just like to signal boost, like the real people, you know, the hoi polloi, the lumpen proletariat. That's we like to give voice to them, you know. Enough people interview journalists, people interview like talking heads and pundits and all that. No, like we love your racist aunt in the comment section. We want to hear what she has to
say.
Those
are the real American patriots, you know.
Yeah, no, Twitter, I go to Twitter a lot for a lot of that stuff. The kind of the format of the show is like a current events show, but it's current events for like the most psycho people imaginable. So some of that does involve like, you know, actual national news. A lot of it is like, oh, they used an interracial couple in this commercial, stuff like that. We like to see what people are talking about and how they're processing it, how like an average person processes politics.
Yeah, it's wild. I mean, you think that like people would calm down about stuff, but they really don't. Like, there still are a bajillion just Archie Bunker types out there who are like furious that there's a black and deaf character in the new Spider-Man game or something, you know? And it's just like, how does this matter to anybody? And you're making it this gigantic culture war thing that just doesn't, I don't know. Like, how much of that just lives on the internet versus like actually gets translated into the real world, you think?
Yeah. Well, it's funny because those people who are complaining, like, they themselves have as much political power as we all do. You know, I mean, there's certain, you know, they might be wealthy or they might be white or something like that and have more like social privilege or something like that. Unless they're like, you know, the owner of a business, unless they're like a factory owner, they have about the same like political power that we do. Mm-hmm. However, because of the alignment of their politics, their interests are vastly overrepresented in Congress and in national politics and even state politics. So it's funny because while I don't think those sentiments are broadly reflected among, you know, I joked about the average person. I mean, maybe the average, like, you know, knowledge-based person or something, the average knowledge-having person. But no, I don't think like the average person actually is like that. They just happen to align with people who have a lot of political power, which again is ironic since they're the ones who are complaining the most. I think they just like, they see the left complaining a lot of the time and they're like, well, we need something to complain about. Otherwise it's just going to move in their direction.
Right.
So we need to have like, we need to have that blast coming from the other side of the aisle, even if it is about woke cereal breakfast or something.
Right. Cracker Jill. Oh, that made him so mad. They got so fucking mad. Stuff like that.
They just want to be in the conversation.
Yeah.
You know?
So when you are, you know, as you've been doing this show, and I asked this question of Tony too, like, how does this, like, sort of week to week weigh on your own mental health when you're just taking in the kind of brain dead comments of all these shitheads? Is it hard sometimes to not internalize it or not feel like alienated, like further alienated, or sometimes just be like, why am I doing this to myself? Like, the world's bad enough. Why am I looking under this particular rock?
Yeah, I guess I have a lot of like reactions to it. I think just to be that guy and say, like, if you follow politics at all, whether you do a podcast about it or not, like, it's a pretty depressing time to be alive, you know, if you're even just paying attention to it. So I would say that like commenting on politics a few times a week is probably cathartic, you know, because I doubt I would stop paying attention. Like, ideally, you know, if I ever stopped doing the podcast, that would mean I could also, quote, like, stop paying attention to politics or whatever and just work and try to be a good person and contribute to my community or whatever and get offline. But I don't see that necessarily. I don't see that being an easy thing to do, because it's not an easy thing to do. It is kind of easier to inform yourself to feel like you're doing something and in turn just like destroy your soul, maybe. But yeah, I don't know. I think like having a place to vent about it is probably pretty good. I do wonder if our chosen format is just pessimistic by nature, because we are covering the reactionaries. We are covering the dipshit responses to our time. I wonder if it can't be a little detrimental or like counterproductive to be highlighting all the bad takes. You know, that's maybe the biggest qualm I have about it.
Right.
I don't want to give anybody this a sense of doom. I don't want to make people lose faith in humanity, because right. I have a lot of faith in humanity, and I try to communicate that. Try to communicate how different this weird online miasma is from just the people out in the world, even if they are reactionaries, or even if they are right-wing shitheads in public. They're probably going to be pretty nice, you know, just statistically speaking. They're probably going to be pretty helpful or like willing to work with you if you actually have something to do in the community, you know. So I try to balance that out, I guess.
Right. I mean it's, as you were saying earlier, like, it can maybe feel overwhelming to just hear so many bad takes over and over. But when you keep in mind at the end of the day that these are just people's opinions that really don't have that much sway and don't really matter that much. Like, I stopped getting so mad at just anybody's internet comments. And this sounds so obvious. This sounds like such a like no duh kind of thing, but the realization I had was just like, oh, that their thoughts don't matter. Their opinion doesn't amount to shit. Like they'll have one vote just like me. They probably don't have really any more sway or power than I do. And it doesn't matter if they think that I'm wrong, or if they think that, you know, this or that person should be like fucking executed or whatever. Like it doesn't really matter. What matters is the, you know, like you were saying, the politicians, and people in power who agree with them and are implementing those things.
Yeah. It's, you know, I think it's true that, you know, the internet is not real life. But it's especially not real life for people with less power. I think if you have more power and more money, you can turn the internet into assemblage of real life, or at least something that can shape real life. Like I think Elon Musk buying Twitter,
yeah,
probably did something, probably had some effect on the cultural zeitgeist. I think if anything, it activated a lot of people to be more online, or to at least be more. It brought a lot of people from Facebook over to Twitter, because there's so many people, so many reactionaries on Facebook, who hate Mark Zuckerberg. A lot of them shifted over to like Truth Social, or, you know, any one of the other fucking failed right wing social media sites. But a lot of people went to Twitter. When Elon Musk bought Twitter, I saw posts in like all my conservative Facebook groups for like a year about how Elon Musk was saving humanity by buying Twitter. So now that's not something you or I could do. Or I couldn't. So it's kind of pointless to be like, well, I need to be online. I need to be online to fight against Elon Musk. I don't think you can do that. You can have fun. You can absolutely have fun. You can make fun of him. You can make him look like an idiot, get a lot of retweets or whatever. That maybe that'll help. But yeah, for people on the left, I don't think there's a lot to be done online except for organizing like real life things,
yeah.
You know, planning or meeting real life people on there. And when you asked earlier about, you know, these reactionaries online, like, is it just an internet thing? You know, the internet is great because it can do things like, you know, bring the band Duster back. Like it can, they have three new albums, I think, because of the internet. Like that's fantastic. It can also connect like a racist in New Jersey with a racist in Arizona.
Yeah.
So now does that translate to political power? No, probably not. Like most of these right-wing fucking phenomena we're seeing is AstroTurf. It's not like, I don't know. Like, it's definitely not real. Like right-wing politics isn't even real life, let alone the internet, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, what is real is the astroturfing, the Koch brothers' money behind a lot of the media that gets made and disseminated to people, and that's where I think anybody who is on the progressive end of things is, they find themselves extremely outgunned, because as it turns out, you know, George Soros and the World Economic Forum and all of those people aren't on our side either. Like, that's not really what we're talking about when we're talking about like a progressive working class left, you know? And so like, if that's the most powerful person, who's apparently sympathetic to our cause and is feeding our like little, you know, is paying us to show up at Antifa, marches and shit like that, then I think we're kind of fucked.
Yeah, really hard to see a path forward without like mass mobilization, mass organizing.
Yeah. So you're the first fellow Teamster I've had on the show. Hell yeah. But I want to know like how you got involved with it and what your experience has been.
Yeah, I've been a Teamster since I started working at UPS in 2006. Mm-hmm. So it's been a lot of years. Been I think 18 years.
Wow.
Last month, 18 years last month. Pretty crazy. I've never been a shop steward. You know, obviously never a business agent. I've never like worked for the union, but I take pride in being a rank and file member of the Teamsters. I'm also rank and file member of TDU. I think that's the shirt you're wearing
right there. Yep.
Yeah, I have the zip up. I can't tell if yours is a zip up.
No, this is the pullover. It's the hoodie.
Yeah. I have a zip up. Yeah, TDU is pretty cool. My stepdad was a UPS driver, and he's the one who was like, you know, go work at UPS. You'll get health insurance while you're going. This is before Obamacare. So you'll like get health insurance while you're going to school. And so I was just working in warehouses and stuff, playing gigs at night, going to school during the day. I had only worked food service before that. Mm-hmm. I had only worked at Pizza Hut and Subway, and both of those places, like, you couldn't really stand up for yourself. You know, the Pizza Hut was cool. Subway was not cool. And I was just like, I was like the senior employee there, and I never got a raise.
Yeah.
You know, I'm still working for like $6.75 or something like that, and locking up the store. You know, I was just like, what are you guys doing here? And
that's
so
what blows my mind about like a lot of those like food service jobs is they give you the keys to not only the store, but like the register, the safe, all of that stuff. And you're still making minimum wage. And it's like, you're trusting me with an awful lot and not really giving me any reason to be trustworthy.
No, I earned that free footlong bonus every night. You know, that was a fun time. I was like 16 or 17. We'd close up. I'd go have sex with one of my coworkers.
Sure.
Get high, come back, and at like 2 a.m. make ourselves sandwiches and raid the cookie drawer and that kind of stuff. But working for UPS like felt like being an adult, even though it like coincided with adulthood, 18. It also just felt like an adult job. Not because it was a better job or not because it was like more worthy or anything like that, but just because, the sort of like autonomy and self-responsibility you have as a union member is just totally different than any other normal job. Like maybe if you're a manager at a non-union job, you have the same sort of like sway. You get to like, you know, stick up for yourself, or you get to have ideas or say no to things if they're not right or if they're not safe. And that's what you can do as a union employee. You know, you have to actually do it. Nobody's going to do it for you. But if your fucking supervisor says, get on that slide and start breaking jams, you could be like, I'm not going to get on that slide and start breaking jams because that's extremely dangerous. I just watched, I just sprayed lubricant on that slide like 30 minutes ago.
Yeah.
So I'm not going to do that. And they can't say anything to you about, they have to be like, I guess you're right.
Yeah.
You know, so it's that was like my first experience with being in a union was, my stepdad, you know, I like my grandpa was union, my dad's union, my uncle's union, my stepdad was union. And he was the first one who was like telling me how much he made as a, as a union guy. Leave it to the stepdad. I fucking love him. Shout out Adam. But, to be like, drop out of school, like right now, drop out of school. Look at how much money I'm making as a UPS driver. I stayed in school for a little bit until, I realized how much money it was going to cost me to like get a doctorate and then how bad the job prospects were going to be after that, trying to, you know, find a teaching job. So I was like, no, I think I'll stop here. And then, worked at UPS for another, probably 3 years before a full-time position opened up. That was the only bad thing was that it was, you know, we're talking, 2006 is when I started. 2008 was the Great Recession. So it was like 9 years before UPS had an opening for a new full-time job for me in Southern California in like one of the biggest buildings down there.
Yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, getting working full-time union like is life-changing. It's like a lot of problems disappear when you're making, you know, 80 grand a year.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like you made the right call. I mean, finished your undergrad but didn't go to grad school? Is that what happened?
I didn't even finish my bachelor's.
You didn't finish your bachelor's. What were you going for?
Philosophy. I changed.
Oh, yeah, no, you really fucking dodged a bullet there, man.
Yeah, I changed my major like 3 times, and the last one was philosophy, and I really enjoyed it, and I was good at it, but I had to be realistic and be like, I'm not going to take out tens of thousands of dollars in loans to go all the way to doctorate for a fucking philosophy degree that I'm only going to be able to teach with or write with. And realistically, you would have to be doing both to survive off of that. And just look at the job prospects. And I was just like, no, I'm not going to do that. So yeah, I mean, I, for having to have a real job, I love my job. I get to be outside. I get to talk with people as much as I want. I get to walk away from people if I don't. I get to stand up for myself to management if I have to, and I get to stand up for myself to the customer if I have to, which is somewhat frequent. But it's, you know, you like develop so many skills, like interacting with the public like that in a way where you have the autonomy, because I'm not developing skills like the same way a department store clerk would have to, where you just have to fucking take whatever the customer, and you learn how to deal with very difficult people on their terms. I'm talking about like problem solving in a way that everybody feels like they were represented in the conversation. You know, you learn how to like navigate a lot of awkward social stuff that I would have had I wouldn't have done, you know, at all probably if I hadn't had this job.
Yeah. Well, on that note, I mean, you said something that I thought was really interesting leading up to the interview. You said, I kind of just got over a lot of my shit, and getting union money helped me kind of force myself to mature and about things, and did, you know, getting union money really did wonders for your mental health. What I thought was interesting about that, I mean, and relatable about that is that money is a huge part of one's mental health, just materially being sound, you know, and not necessarily like making money hand over fist, but like having enough that you feel sort of solid. And when you were talking earlier about how, like, you know, if you're in like a non-union retail job and you just have to kind of like eat plates of shit from the customer, and feeling, I know it, like I've felt like this a lot, and I'm starting to kind of just not feel like this, but feeling that sense of kind of pleading and kind of desperation, and this sort of Gollum like feeling of just like, please let me continue to have this meager job so that I can survive, versus having just an iota of dignity and being able to say just like, nope, I'm actually a grown man and I'm not going to take this or that, and this is how this is going to work. And just having self-respect that's just derived somewhat from your working position and your working conditions is huge. So, you know, can you talk about that a little bit and what your experience has been?
Yeah, I mean, I really feel for people who don't have workplace representation and do have to sacrifice their dignity or their respect or eat shit, you know, so that they can keep their job. It's one of the most like fundamental, I think, values, or, you know, I don't really like to talk about human rights because I feel like human rights, unfortunately, are what we make them. You know, I'm not particularly religious or anything, so I don't believe in like a divine granting of human rights or whatever that is. We do have to like make these rights for ourselves and secure them. I think workplace democracy is like at the very, if we're not going to have like state-run factories and a state-run economy, the very least workplace democracy, I think, is like a great next step for us. And I think it's a great rallying cry for people. You know, people tend to understand how important democracy is and how important it is for you to feel like you have a say in shaping your world and shaping the reality. And you have a chance to do something, to better yourself or to change yourself or to better the world or whatever. And all of that goes out the door as soon as you clock in. You don't have that anymore. You know, and I know people might cringe at the term wage slave or whatever. It's obviously not the same as actual slavery.
Right.
But it's as undemocratic as actual, you know, you can just add an at-will work, at-will state, at-will, what is it called? At-will employment?
Yeah, at-will employment, I think, yeah.
You just, they don't need to give you a reason to fire you. You're just gone. You just don't make money anymore. And it's phenomenal that we've allowed people to have that power over us, you know? And so I think that appealing to people's self-respect and appealing to people's maturity, like, is a good way to point out the class dynamic, to point out how fucked up the class dynamic is. And it brings it home in a way that, you know, saying the 1% or this, that, or the other doesn't, like, everybody kind of hates rich people, but that goes out the window when you have a vested interest in keeping your job. You know, that goes out the window when you have to play the internal politics of your workplace where it is extremely one-sided, and yeah, you have very little power. So I think reminding people, you know, about the power of labor and about the power of organizing, specifically through the lens of workplace democracy, is very important. And, you know, how that relates to mental health, I would just say, yeah, it feels good to be able to stand up for yourself, you know?
Yeah. It's just, I mean, I've said this before, but like all I talk to my therapist about anymore is money. And it's been that way for like a while now. And the link between material conditions and mental health is just, it's inseparable. And it's the reason why I talk about money and class politics and stuff like that on this show, not only because it's like an important issue to me, but because like this is a mental health podcast. And I thought for a while of like kind of making it more a political, you know, more in like the footsteps of, I don't know, say Mental Illness Happy Hour, where like, and I love that show, but like he tends to be more politically neutral and talk more just specifically about mental health issues with people. But then I thought like, well, that's his vibe and that's his show and that's how he's doing it. But I'm going to do it a different way, and I'm going to do it with the millennial approach, because our generation has had our mental health shaped thoroughly by our experience with capitalism and what it's done to us, and it's shaped our psyches, you know, since forever. And yeah. You can't ignore it. You can't ignore the material conditions of it. And the idea that, and I think this is like a becoming more of an outdated idea, that mental health and navel gazing kind of stuff is only for wealthy or upper middle class people. And it's sort of this privileged way of looking at things. And when you're looking at, you know, like the hierarchy of needs, like, sure, yeah, you're not, you know, like people who have their base needs met, they have more time to worry about that stuff. But people who don't, like, that also weighs hugely on their mental health.
Yeah, they're still experiencing hardship, mental hardship. They just don't have the leisure to like intellectualize it at the rate of a normal podcaster. But yeah, it's hard to describe like how much, because I don't know what I have. I've never been diagnosed with anything. I got something, I know, but I think my problem is like overthinking things, you know. And when I didn't have stable income or stable relationships, that's what I thought about a lot, and it was not healthy. It was definitely did not feel good. It was not healthy. I definitely self-medicated. But it was around, yeah, when I was like 18 through like, you know, mid 20s or whatever, I really had to like take a step back from even like socializing and just figure out what was important to me, what kind of person I wanted to be, how I was reacting to the world around me. And there was just like so much stuff I didn't like about myself, so many behaviors I didn't like about myself. Luckily, I did have like a fairly stable familial foundation and economic foundation. You know, I wasn't going to starve, but I also like was not making a great living. But because I like did take that time to like reassess and sort of become okay with me and with who I was and like figure out what I wanted to do, I stopped worrying about the stuff that had been vexing me like my whole life, like how to socialize properly with people, or how to, you know, even just make friends or feel important or feel valued and you know, be funny or be popular or whatever. I stopped worrying about that as much. And that's, you know, that's pretty generic thing. Grow up, stop worrying about everything all the time or whatever, you know, easier said than done.
Yeah.
To be sure. But, no, I was like, you know, I was aggrieved. I thought I was smarter than I was given credit for. I thought I was funnier than I was given credit for. Mm-hmm. I thought I was cooler and all that. And it led to resentment, you know, for like, why don't people yeah. want to hang out?
Well, was there like a chip on your shoulder kind of era of like, I was going to school for philosophy, I'm smart motherfuckers, and now I'm working at UPS and all my old classmates look down their nose at me?
No, not at all. I was over my shit before I started working at UPS. I was like thrilled to, I mean, yeah. Cause a ton of my friends are in academia and in literary pursuits, and
yeah. and they make like 40K a year, and they're,
I see how much they struggle, yeah. and I'm just like, I'm fucking blessed to be doing what I'm doing. No, my agreement was just like all personal and social and like not really economic at all. And you know, I never like became a reactionary or anything, but I definitely had like unhealthy ideas about women, or like subconscious ideas about women and, you know, what I was owed from women, or what women should or shouldn't do, that sort of thing. And just, but I've had women friends my whole life, and they were the ones who helped me like,
yeah,
realize that I was being a shithead, not by like having an intervention or whatever, but by me just like listening to them, you know, talking to them and actually taking their word for it when they talked about abuse and harassment and, you know, their hardships and things like that. And just because you tried to talk to a girl on the quad and she wouldn't pay attention to you doesn't mean she's like a bitch. And it just means like, not every girl wants to talk to a guy on the quad, you know, somebody just doesn't want to fucking talk to you. And it might not even be like because of you, it just might not be in the mood, you know?
Yeah, and she might just be having even a handsome dude like you, you might step to somebody and they don't even like, you know, they're just like, not today, you know?
Yeah. And it's just, I was anti-racist. I was like all this stuff, but I still had these things that I had to work out, you know.
It's hard not to. I mean, like I think there's a seed of a little incel in all of us, you know, and it's just a matter of recognizing it. And that usually starts to manifest itself in your 20s when you are horny all the time, and you're socializing, you're meeting all these girls, and it's not going how you thought it would, and there is just this, like, I was told that I was supposed to get all this pussy, and what's happening, and this isn't right, and if you don't kind of stop and step back from that and think about your entitlements and your prejudices and your privileges, then you can go down a bad path.
Yeah. You have to be able to empathize with other people. I think to like ever help yourself, you really have to be able to listen to other people and, have something outside yourself to roll around in your head, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, so it's I'm glad that, you know, you've been able to recognize that, and it's not an easy thing to do. And I think that, you know, a lot of people, I don't trust people who claim that they have never had those sorts of like shitty attitudes or resentments or prejudices or anything like that, because it just, nobody is born with a perfect fucking attitude. You have to have that sort of beaten into you sometimes by the world, and you have to like recognize some shit and make some mistakes in order to understand why it is you were fucking up.
Yeah, you got to be humbled. You got to be humbled at some point. Hopefully everybody gets humbled at some point, because, mm-hmm. you know, it doesn't have to be a painful necessarily way, but just, you know, a reminder that we're all equal, you know, we should all be working together, you know?
Yeah. Well, and when it comes to that, on like the front of like labor organizing, you know, working within a labor union, you know, the Teamsters, the stereotype of the Teamster is this sort of like gruff, fucking, you know, somewhat ignorant, uneducated, knuckle dragging kind of guy. Right. And that, in my experience, hasn't really been the case, but like, there is something to be said about working class solidarity and getting together with people who, like, part of the time they might be writing those dumbass Facebook posts, but they're also in your union, and you also have to like get together with them on a united front when it comes to something surrounding your job, and not be okay with bigoted attitudes that they might have. But if you show up and stand side by side with them and work together with them on that front, then they are more likely to listen to you when it comes to stuff about, you know, feminism or trans rights or things that they might not understand yet. Might be easier to convince them if you have stood up for them and helped them have better conditions for their job.
Sure. And I mean, just by default, you're a peer. If this is your coworker, that's your peer. And you know, you can't pick your coworker. You can't pick your family. You can't pick your coworkers. And everybody's got stories of getting along, of having to get along with the asshole at work, or, you know, the psycho at work, or the snitch, or yada, yada, yada. Like, everybody's got those stories. Everybody's had to do that. But it's only when it comes to like union organizing that suddenly people are like, can you really organize with somebody who voted Republican? And it's like, who else are you going to organize with? These are the people in your job. These are the people you have to organize with if you want to. And I don't give a shit about if they voted Republican. Like, I mean, it's bad. It's bad that they did that. That's got nothing to do with the power that you are organizing for in work. You know, if you want to talk to them about it, about why they shouldn't or whatever, yeah, sure, that's normal workplace conversation, politics and all that. It's probably not going to be pretty fruitful. It's probably not going to be that help. Like, I don't mention Republican, Democrat. I don't mention politicians by name. I just carry a healthy disdain for all politicians and the two major political parties whenever I enter these discussions, and I've never had a problem. I've never, you know, experienced any pushback at all. But yeah, being in a union or being in a workplace is a lot like a family in terms of there's just like things you have to look past. I've never had a coworker like use a racial slur around me. That was actually management. The one time a white supervisor thought he could get away with saying the N-word in front of me because it was just us. He found out different. I've never, you know, I've experienced transphobia from a coworker. I had a coworker show me a meme, a transphobic meme. And this was like a dude, I knew him vaguely. I knew his name, you know, I knew he was a Christian. He was like a really nice Christian guy. And he showed me this meme and I was just like, oh, I don't agree with that dude. And he was like, oh yeah, me either. You know, I don't agree with men in women's bathroom, yada, yada, yada. And I was like, no, I don't agree with you and that meme. Like, don't you, I said, this was like while I was punching in. So I had like a 30-second window to talk. I was just like,
that's the thing. People, like these conversations sometimes come up when you're just like, you're already busy and you're already just like, I don't quite have time for this, but I do need to like, let's put a pin in this. Right. Anyway,
you gotta have your talking points ready. You gotta have your like three or four bullet, you know, not even that many, probably two bullet points you can get out over your shoulder as you're walking to your package car or something like that. But yeah, I just said, no, man, like those people already have such a hard time. Like trans people already have such a hard time. I'm not interested in making fun of them. I'm not interested in making it any, cause I knew he was a Christian. Right. And I had seen him like exhibit thoughtful and caring behavior before. And I was just like, this is, if I was going to talk to this guy about it, I would appeal to his compassion. You know, I wouldn't get mad at him. I wouldn't try to shame him or anything like that. I would just, can you imagine trying to be a fucking trans person? And this was back in, you know, 2018 or something. In a lot of ways, we got more reactionary against trans people, but we've also gotten more accepting of trans people, I think, too. And I don't know. I think that was something. Hopefully he remembered. Hopefully he thought about that. What a mean way of thinking about things.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah. It is just those little baby step conversations, I think, that you can have with people. But like the overarching unity of being in a union with somebody, with being in a like workplace solidarity, I think really. Like you said, it's like a family. These are like the like loud Catholic Italian uncles I never had. And, you know, God bless them. I definitely don't agree with them on everything, but we're together on when it comes to certain things. And focusing on that first, I think is important. And that's what, you know, a liberal, like vote blue no matter who kind of person tries to appeal to, like, well, you don't just get your way all the time and you can't be absolutist about it and politics is about compromise. I'm like, motherfucker, that's what I'm doing. I am compromising with people who I don't agree with on everything, and we are uniting on something that we do agree on, and we'll go from there, right?
Right, yeah. It's like Bernie going on Joe Rogan. It was like, well, Bernie's a fascist collaborator.
Everybody was so mad at him for that. And like, you know, like I'm mad at him for other reasons now, but like I wasn't mad at him for that because I was just like, okay, if he can win over a bunch of like Joe Rogan, like gym rat shitheads, then fine. Great. I think that helps the cause. If Rogan says vote for this guy, they'll vote for him because they do everything he says. And that would be good.
Yeah, like him on Joe Rogan was good. Cornel West on Joe Rogan was good. Both of them made some boo-boos recently.
Yeah.
Bernie's been a pretty big disappointment the last, you know, last year or so. But it's just funny when they give the game away. The Democrats, the big D Democrats and their fans, they give the game away when they say things like, "Yeah, oh, you're working with the enemy if you go talk to Joe Rogan." as opposed to Joe Biden is being the adult in the room by trying to pass Republicans' border bill.
Yeah.
You know, like, one of those is very obviously worse than the other. It's not even a question, you know. So they just they don't, you know, the Democratic Party stands absolutely do not want, you know, it is that meme of like the rural guy and the urban guy fist bumping, but just, you know, one of them shouldn't have a Confederate flag.
Yeah,
basically. But it is that is what like the powers that be fear. They fear us getting over the culture war to do class war, you know. And yeah, that's the shit you should be talking about at work, you know, not which public facing spokesperson Doritos hired and how that person is a woke whatever.
Yeah.
You know, like a lot of this stuff that blows up online sounds absolutely insane if you say it in person. And it's that's kind crazy. Of like,
yeah,
one thing we on the left, I think, have going for us is that we don't have to blow up insane things to where they would sound completely alien to a normal person. Now, it might be upsetting to a normal person, the stuff that your average leftist is aware of that's going on in the world. But it will probably sound a fair bit more substantial than Space Force went woke or whatever, you know?
Yeah. So my girlfriend is wonderfully kind of offline. She doesn't really like engage in a whole lot of like Twitter discourse kind of shit. And so to bring things like that to her and like try and I'll make some offhand comment about, you know, Kid Rock shooting up Bud Light or something. She's like, what are you talking about? And I was like, okay, so like Kid Rock got mad at Bud Light because they hired Dylan Mulvaney to do a thing. And then everybody, and it just sounds so fucking stupid like to like somebody who's uninitiated to it. And they're like, what are you, what? And, it is just that, like, it doesn't matter to most people who aren't just like furiously scrolling, you know. It's nothing.
Yeah, I mean, I think they have to like make themselves crazy because they're still not happy despite having such a conservative government and such a vicious economic system, a vicious housing system, medical, like, it punishes all the right people according to them, you know what I mean?
It
punishes all the bad people that they hate, but they still can't be happy because it's not good for anybody. Even if you enjoy the misery, that's still bad for you, you know. And so they find things that they can be mad about. And most of it is like, yeah, what's on TV or what's in their Facebook or Twitter feed.
Yeah. It's annoying and it's frustrating. And I mean, I guess to kind of like wrap it up on a semi-positive note is just like being so disappointed and disillusioned with electoral politics in the last, I don't know, 7-8 years, something like that, has been one thing, but watching, especially over the last couple of years, seeing labor politics start to really pick up some steam. I mean, the UPS thing that was happening over last summer was pretty exciting. And, you know, I know that like you have some nuance or mixed feelings about like the deal that the Teamsters reached with UPS. But I think overall, just the fact that that Sean O'Brien and Sean Fain and these like progressive union leaders are making themselves known, are getting headlines, and people are talking about labor unions and strikes and you know, unions forming at these new places for the first time in like forever, I think is encouraging and is maybe the only power that we really have. Like, I have so checked out of electoral politics and presidential politics at this point that like now the thing that actually gives me hope is something like this.
Yeah, Sean Fain's been really cool. The only thing is him just endorsing Biden in the midst of Israel's us funding Israel's genocide of Gaza. That's a little disheartening because
it doesn't make sense. Because didn't the UAW call for a ceasefire too? Like
they called for a ceasefire, and they also implemented I don't know what you would call what they called it, like an inquiry about divesting from Israel, which would be great. Yeah, if they divested pension funds and other like things that the UAW may donate to that related to Israel, that would be fantastic. But yeah, when it came to endorsing Biden, very bizarre. I don't know why they thought that.
I don't know. I guess they thought they had to pick a guy. I don't know. But they didn't. They could have just been like, no, fuck them both. And that would have scared the shit out of them. Like,
it's also so early. You know, I don't, you had plenty of time if you wanted to actually wheel and deal something. But other than that, no, I like Sean Fain a lot. Sean O'Brien, again, my president, has been doing a few things here and there that are concerning, but I overall believe that, it's an improvement. It's vast improvement over the old lineage, and people have seen their work get results within the Teamsters. You know, for people who don't know, the Teamsters president is a reform candidate. He was not the successor's picked legacy. He was not the Hoffa candidate, Hoffa Jr., who, you know, we had a lot of problems with by and large in the Teamsters. Picked a different slate to back, and Sean O'Brien won with the help of TDU. He was a basically a TDU guy, and that's contagious. You know, I don't think people are going to not give Sean O'Brien shit the next time we're working towards a contract. You know, I think people got a little taste for victory. Even if a lot of people were disappointed, I don't really necessarily agree with that. I was like, I would describe my reaction to the contract as like fairly positive. Fairly positive. Yeah. There was stuff that I feel like maybe we could have gotten more, but we also scared the shit out of UPS, and we basically did a disruption without actually going on strike, because a lot of accounts were lost during that time of uncertainty. And if we had actually gone on strike, there would have been even more accounts lost. I know some buildings are dealing with layoffs right now. A lot of those layoffs are management. A lot of those firings, there's like something in the news about UPS firing, 150,000 workers or something like that. They were talking about management, about supervisors who were not union. But I do know that there are drivers that are being laid off, and it's the lighter time of year, so that could be just related to the economy in general, not necessarily to the contract. But anyway, there's still stuff we should be fighting for, and I think we got a little taste of that labor power, we got a little taste of that reform power last year, and I think that might be, that might tempt people into doing it again.
Yeah. Hell yeah.
It's contagious. The victory feels good.
It's incrementalism. It's that thing that fucking liberals are always harping on. It's like, yeah, we understand that things don't happen overnight. We are making small steps towards a better future. And again, this is how things get done. And it's not always perfect, but we push forward. Keep pushing forward. This has been really lovely, and let's do plugs and everything, and then we can get you out of here. Talk about how people want to find you and your show and all of that stuff.
Yeah, so I'm at Fleeldy on Twitter, Fleeldy. It's a portmanteau of the two best bassists in the world. You can find Minion Death Cult wherever you listen to podcasts. Just go to MinionDeathCult.com or just search it in your podcast app. We do bonus episode every week for Patreon subscribers, patreon.com/MinionDeathCult. We don't do advertisers or paid programming or anything like that. We're entirely listener funded, so that's where you can go to get a bonus episode every week and a live stream we do with listeners on Saturdays. And thanks for having me on. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, man. Thanks once again to Alexander Edward. Check out his show. Check out Minion Death Cult. It's fun. It's just a fun little dive into the... Just... You know how the internet be. You know how the internet... just brings out the silliest fucking stupidity. Oh my god. I was going for a different word and then I went into stupidity and it really became a train wreck. I'm not gonna edit that. But yeah, check out that show. It's fun. It's a good vibe. It's a good hang. And that's all. I'm gonna leave now. I'm going to let you get to your next podcast, whatever's next in your queue. Music is by Shay Bartel. Thank you, Shay. And that's all for me. Until next week, wear a good windbreaker. Don't let it get you down. And remember to wash. Hygiene's important.